Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Deadhead Cannabis Show. This is Larry Mishkin of the Hoban Law Group. I am speaking to you today from my office in lovely Northbrook, Illinois. Today is a day why they invented air conditioning. 95 degrees, humidity that, like, you know, gets you soaked just by walking to your car. And generally a nice day to look at from the inside, but not really pleasant to be on at the outside. And somehow I seem to recall this being the exact weather pattern every time the dead would come to Alpine Valley up in Minnesota, up in Wisconsin. And we'd all go up there for 4 days of camping. And it, of course, would be the hottest 4 days of the summer. Having said all of that, we're about to be joined by my partner in crime, Jim Marty of the Bridge West group. And Jim's going to join us right now. So all of the listeners are aware, Jim going above and beyond the call today. He's out on the East Coast, and I'll let him fill us in on the details in a car. So if you catch a little bit of background noise from Jim, it's just because he's working and talking and doing it all at the same time. Jim, how are you?
Very good. Very good. I'm in a car going 65 miles an hour, but I am not driving, thank goodness.
Good.
I'm here in Massachusetts. I'm on an 8-day road trip visiting clients in Massachusetts and Maryland. And give you an update. We'll probably talk some prices today. You've got some new numbers for us, and I've got some numbers to share too. As you probably know, Colorado is seeing a big surge in prices. And even though we've had strong cultivation for over 10 years, we're starting to see spot shortages on the market.
Really? Is that due to an increase in consumer demand, or is that because people just aren't growing as much as they used to?
No, Colorado's been setting a record 3 months in a row now for sales. And we've actually seen wholesale prices for top shelf crossed. Now they're above $3,000 a pound at wholesale. And our retail clients are raising retail prices correspondingly. I think there's a lot of people that are working from home from COVID. Some of them have extra unemployment money in their pockets. So we've seen absolute record sales in Colorado.
Fantastic.
Prices are pretty strong in Maryland as well. And in Massachusetts, they're selling an eighth of an ounce for $65.
Well, I got to tell you, in Illinois, they're selling an eighth of an ounce for $60, and a gram of concentrate for $60. So, you know, for us, that's just standard pricing here for right now. And, it gets better, I imagine, as soon as we get a few more people into the marketplace, so we get a little bit more of a supply. But here, talk about numbers, Jim. The Illinois numbers for July came out. In the month of July, the Illinois adult use program combined sold 1,270,000 items. First time they've crossed the million threshold of items sold in a month. They had total sales setting another record here of 60,956,000. Of which 44 million was in state, but here's the big number: over 16 million was from out of state customers. And we've talked for a long time about one of the things that really makes Illinois unique is its location right here in the heart of the Midwest, surrounded by states, none of whom yet have adult use programs. And only one of them really, Missouri, which has an act, well, and they're not even totally up and running yet, a medical program. These numbers are just outstanding. Again, you know, coming at a time when a lot of things are shut down and people are not venturing out as much as they otherwise would. And we see these numbers. But here's the thing, Jim. These numbers are just part of a national trend. And I had some time yesterday and was able to go online and pull down some data from Marijuana Business Daily, who, again, is always great in terms of the information they supply about this industry. And I saw some statistics, and I have to tell you, Jim, it took me back. I know you and I have talked about it on the show and other times. The first time we met was back in 2013 in Seattle at the second ever MJ Biz conference. They had about 700 people, and we were all in the clubhouse of a racetrack just south of Seattle. And everybody sat in one room and listened to all the presentations. And then we all went downstairs and saw the five or six exhibitors. But somebody put a slide on the screen that talked about the number of dollars on marijuana sales in the country, both black market and legal. And at the time, you know, the legal, if you did a chart, was so close to the baseline that you couldn't even see what color it was. There wasn't enough space to see the color. And they were projecting things on 2016 and 2020 and 2025 and these numbers that just seemed absolutely out of control. And in fact, what we learned was now what we see is that in 2012, it was all medical being sold. And nationwide, it was about $1.2 to $1.3 billion of sales. By 2016, medical was up to $2.2 to $2.78 billion, but adult use was now on the scene, and that was pulling in just under $2 billion a year. Now we get to 2020. The numbers are even more amazing. Medical is now up to $5.8 to $7.2 billion a year, and adult use is $9.75 to $11.90 billion a year. What's significant, Jim, about 2020 is that adult use for the first time has passed medical in terms of legal sales in this country. And what's amazing about that is that we have 37 states with medical programs, but only 12 states with adult use programs. What do you think about that?
Yes, I agree with all of that. It has been an amazing ride. And in reality, the cannabis industry in the United States is over $100 billion a year. It's just that it's still the majority of it is still on the illicit market. And you and I have been part of this cosmic change, this galactic shift, from the illicit market to the legal market. And that's going on. You know, Colorado alone is going to do well over $2 billion this year. Sales are very strong in Massachusetts. Again, it's got adult use and it's surrounded by states, Connecticut, New York, Vermont, New Hampshire, that do not have adult right. use. So, but yeah, that's my goal in the next few years, or my dream, I guess, is to see the legal cannabis market catch up with beer at $110 billion a year.
That would be something, wouldn't it? And I have to tell you, you know, just looking at the way these numbers have gone, there's no reason to believe it won't happen. And, you know, as we say, welcome to the party, the more the merrier. Something else to keep in mind is that this fall, in this next round of elections, of course, everyone's primarily focused on the presidential election, and understandably so, but not to get lost in the shuffle, is that five states have marijuana ballot measures that are going to be presented to their citizens. Arizona is finally voting on adult use. Mississippi is going to be voting on medical. Montana, which for a while was big and then had some problems during the Obama administration in the pre-Cole memorandum days, and is now making a bounce back on the medical side. They have adult use on the ballot coming up, as does New Jersey. And New Jersey wasn't able to get it done last time. Although what's interesting about New Jersey here, Jim, is that New Jersey tried to do it legislatively and wasn't able to do it. And now they're going to try and do it with a popular vote election and see if they can do it that way. And then finally, South Dakota, they actually have two ballot measures, one for medical and one for adult use. And of course, I'm sure from South Dakota's perspective, as we all know, they just recently ended the annual Sturgis motorcycle rally out there, where they get probably half, 500,000 people at least, if not more, you know, who are all coming out and drinking and just having a good old time. And by God, if they had adult use marijuana in South Dakota, that would be something.
Yeah, and I believe Mississippi is going to have a medical marijuana ballot initiative.
Yep, that's right. So this is all great to see, right? Because as these states bring in their programs, whether adult use or medical, and you know, while we're very always happy to see adult use, medical is great too, because it's getting the foot in the door in a state and ultimately will lead to adult use in one kind or another. But especially, you know, to see a state like Mississippi, which is, you know, typically, you know, portrayed as a very, very conservative state, you know, to be opening up and accepting medical, which, you know, to my thinking is almost more of a big move for a state like that than adult use, because they're actually acknowledging by going medical that there are medical benefits to cannabis. And that's great to see. You know, it strengthens the industry overall. You know, and the more it spreads out over this country, eventually even the feds will have to recognize the fact that popular demand is so great, Schedule One just doesn't make sense anymore on any level. And although I know you and I have talked about, you know, the benefits of the industry with Schedule One rating on the Controlled Substances Act versus being descheduled altogether, you know, it's still going to be one of those things that people are going to talk about. Except, and you and I mentioned this at the top of the show or right before we hopped on, that, you know, this is a show about marijuana. This is a show about the Grateful Dead. And, you know, we try to leave all of the politics and all of that aside. But I took note of the fact that, you know, think what you want of the Democrat National Convention, but they didn't mention marijuana. And I was a little surprised and disappointed that it wasn't really mentioned in any meaningful way. And although the Republicans still have a couple of nights to go, I'd be very surprised if we hear any of the speakers who are still to come using their time to talk about marijuana. And, you know, given where we are in the industry and given where things are going and the bilateral passage of this SAFE Act in the House of Representatives, it would be refreshing to hear one politician in either party or both parties or anywhere just get up on stage and say, look, with all of this other stuff, let's not lose sight of the fact that there's an industry growing out there right now that's unlike anything else this country has ever seen.
Yes. And from my point of view, I am just fine with them not mentioning marijuana. I prefer to fly under the radar and get the fix that we want. Definitions are very important. Harris talks about decriminalization. You know, what does that mean? Does that mean descheduling? Does that mean the States Act, which would keep it illegal at the federal level and make it give it to the states to regulate cannabis as they choose? So there's a lot of unknowns. As our listeners have heard me say many times, the devil you know is better than the devil you don't know.
Well, I think that's true. And, you know, likewise, you know, your comments are all very well taken. And they serve as a very effective, you know, rebuttal to me lamenting the fact that it's not being mentioned. And maybe the answer is that those of us in the industry right now are a whole lot better off with it not being mentioned at all and just leave us alone and let us do our thing. It's working out okay for us on the state levels right now in the states that we're in. The federal government has done a pretty decent job under both, you know, Democratic and Republican administrations, leaving the industry alone. And it doesn't really look like there's any natural enemies out there, you know, that are going to come swooping in and cause the kind of trouble that would, you know, demand or require legalization. So, you know, while there's certainly benefits, banking and otherwise that come with it, if all of a sudden the doors are open to the gigantic industry of the world, a lot of people who now play a role in the industry might very quickly find themselves on the outside looking in.
Correct. As I've said on the show in the past, which is the first federal agency that's going to be knocking on their cannabis business door? The FDA, alcohol, tobacco, firearms. Sure. You can put that soup of federal agencies, and then you've got big alcohol, big tobacco.
Well, you know, Jim, the nice thing is we don't even have to imagine or pretend to imagine, because we saw what happened with hemp and CBD when the farm bill was passed. You know, the FDA couldn't get to the microphone fast enough to say, hey, welcome to regulatory jurisdiction, guys. You know, you're no longer on the criminal side, but now you're on the regulatory side. And that's, you know, almost brought a halt in some places to CBD infused food items because the FDA has finally said we're going to get involved. And, you know, they're making life difficult for everyone without even trying to do it. And there's no doubt that once we get the feds involved, we do run into those problems. But, you know, there's a few of us that wouldn't be so sad to see 280 go away. Although I do recognize that some of us make a living off of 280. So there's a lot to be said for that, too.
Yeah, 280 makes it very difficult to have a profit, but it can be done. It's a very narrow path to profitability, but it can be done.
Yep.
There's not a lot of room for error. Recent months, I've been hired quite a bit to do profitability consulting.
Yep.
In the last few days with a Maryland client. And here on the East Coast, it seems like infused products and edibles are higher percentage of sales than out in Colorado where I'm from. I was at a sophisticated kitchen, and they make a 35 milligram gummy. And I said, wow, 35 milligrams, that's pretty strong. And the lady said, no, you can cut them in quarters. We put little dotted lines on them. But
wow,
10,000 of these a week, and they're all pre-sold.
Okay. Well, and you know, while all this is going on, I've been working with people who are all taking a very strong interest in the Oklahoma market all of a sudden. And just when I thought that the Oklahoma market was as oversaturated as it could be, there's people who think that there's more room to be had there, and they want to go diving in there. And quite frankly, the prices have gone up in Oklahoma, which I thought was pretty amazing. So really, any way you turn and you look at it right now, it's just pretty incredible to see.
Yes, we have clients in Oklahoma. Very interesting model in that most of the clients we consult with there are very small. I call them boutique cultivations of about 5 or 10,000 square feet. No real big operators, you know, with 50 or 100,000 square feet of cultivation right now.
Right.
But the small guys are producing and doing quite well.
Yep, that's great to see. That's great to see. Well. Turning to some of the other things that we like to talk about, and I hope that you guys have your radio squarely set away on XM Radio, Grateful Dead, or the Fish Channel, because it can take you many, many miles and keep you happy. Here's something, Jim, and I have to tell you, not that I consider myself, you know, the leading authority on the dead, far from it, far from it. Although I do like to think that I know more than the average bear when it comes to stuff about the Grateful Dead. And what I found as I've gotten older and read up on the dead and seen the movies about them and heard the stories from people is you kind of get to the point where you figure you've heard just about every big thing that ever could have happened for the Grateful Dead one way or another. Maybe you don't know the whole story, you only know part of the story. But there's very few things I find about that I, you know, that I learned these days about the Grateful Dead where I say, wow, I never knew that before. However, that's why we have our wonderful producer, Dan Humiston, who is always scouting the airwaves for new and interesting tidbits and sent something over to us the other day that really kind of knocked my socks off. And it's this little fact that in April of 1970, Miles Davis one night opened for the Grateful Dead in San Francisco. And I just hear that and I'm amazed because we've all heard of the Allman Brothers playing with the Dead, and we've all heard of Stephen Stills playing with the Dead and all sorts of people playing with Branford Marsalis and his, you know, world famous Eyes of the World from 1989 Nassau Coliseum with the Grateful Dead. And yet in 1970, one night in April at Bill Graham's Fillmore West in San Francisco, it just so happened that, you know, the worlds of Miles Davis and the Grateful Dead collided and he wound up opening for them. And there's a great article, and maybe Dan can post the link on our webpage and other people can come and read it. And there's a cutout of one of the tunes that Miles Davis performed, one of his numbers called Directions. And you can listen to that. But the story is fascinating about, you know, how it came together and how Bill Graham, who was, you know, their promoter for life, was smart enough to figure out that the Dead fans who were really into, you know, long drawn out improvisational jams would also dig the same thing coming from a blues trumpeter. And from Miles Davis's perspective, you know, he had always played nightclubs and relatively, you know, smaller venues like that for the really hardcore jazz fans. And here he was coming out, you know, playing, as he called it, for a bunch of really spacey high white people who were walking around and talking. But then they stopped and they started listening to the music and talks about how he started out from some of his works and sketches of Spain and went into his more well-known Bitches Brew stuff. And he said it, you know, just blew them out. And he said after that, anytime he would come to San Francisco to play gigs, he would see a lot of white people showing up at the gigs. And he realized that it must have come from that. And I'm going to ask you in a second, Jim, but I checked with all of my deadhead friends. And, you know, there's some of these guys who are like, you know, my deadhead gurus who saw the dead 300 or 400 times and, you know, hung out with the roadies and everything. And not one of them had heard about this. They, you know, in any kind of a meaningful way. Were you aware that Miles and the Dead had shared a stage?
I was not, although I'm not surprised because having read Phil's book and some books on Jerry, they would go and see Miles Davis every chance they could, especially when he came to San Francisco. Phil would load up and Phil would drag them all down to see Miles Davis and they'd all walk out of there very impressed. So it's no surprise. But I don't believe they ever actually jammed together, at least in front of an audience.
You're correct. And that's, although the story doesn't say so conclusively, I would assume that if they had actually, and you're right, I misspoke when I said shared a stage in terms of opening act and second act as opposed to playing together. There's nothing here that suggests that they did play any music together that day, which is really too bad. And in fact, it may have been, it was an incredibly lost opportunity that they apparently never had a chance to do again. But you're right about Garcia and Lesh. And in fact, Davis was quoted at the time as saying that he learned about how Jerry loved jazz. And Miles Davis found out that Jerry loved Miles Davis's music and had been listening to it for a long, long time. And then there's a great quote at the very end of the story from Phil Lesh that I think really kind of sums it up. And Phil's quoted as saying, as I listened leaning over the amps with my jaw hanging agape, trying to comprehend the forces that Miles was unleashing on stage, I was thinking, what's the use? How can we possibly play after this? With this band, Miles literally invented fusion music. In some ways, it was similar to what we were trying to do in our free jamming, but ever so much more dense with ideas and seemingly controlled with an iron fist, even at its most alarmingly intense moments. And you know, that's such Phil Lesh talking, but you know, only he could come up with a way like that to describe a guy like Miles Davis, who was a monument for his time. And you know, that's one of the things that I also love is, you know, when the guys who I idolize in music, guys like the Grateful Dead, are talking about the people that they idolize. And you know, how much better than that can it be?
No, I agree. And of course that all winds its way through the Fish family and the Fish jam music, which I've been listening to quite a bit while I've been on the road. When my rental cars have Sirius radio.
Sure.
I think I mentioned on the last 1998 being one of the favorite Fish the guest DJs are up on the Fish radio channel. And of course, Frank Zappa was a big influence on Trey.
Yeah, that's right. I've heard him talk about that as well. And I think Frank Zappa, you know, was probably a big influence on just about anybody who played a guitar around that time. And I know that, you know, we've talked about it, and I, you know, don't want to be one of those guys who revisits old stories over and over again. But in 1984, seeing the Jerry Garcia Band and Frank Zappa play together at the UIC Pavilion in Chicago was also a pretty amazing night of music. And at first we were all bummed because they had flipped a coin backstage, and that night Garcia opened, so he played a shorter set. But by the time Zappa got going, you know, we couldn't get enough of him, and we were happy to get as much of him as we did, and it was just tremendous. But it's great to see that kind of appreciation, but especially something like this, you know, because it's almost like two different generations. You know, it would be like if a guy like Don Drysdale got to pitch to Ken Griffey Jr., you know, after having pitched to his father or something. You know, you have one generation reach over into the next one and just touch just like that. And not necessarily a passing of the torch, because the Dead weren't a full jazz band, but, you know, certainly two amazing musical performers whose paths crossed once, and the folks who were there got very, very lucky. So I would recommend go ahead.
I said you got one on me, because I never got to see Frank Zappa before he passed away.
Well, you know, we could do that one day too. We could all talk about, you know, the top five we were lucky to see and the top five that we missed, because, you know, they're all out there. And It's a grass is always greener, right? I always used to sit around, and I love Brent Midland, and I think Brent Midland was just a tremendous, tremendous keyboardist. But I always wondered how great it would have been to have heard Keith Gauchow, or even go back further and Tom Constantin and Pigpen playing the organ. And then when I went and visited my younger brother when he was in college in the 1990s, after Brent had passed away, and all of his buddies who were late blooming deadheads by that point would all look at me and say, "Oh my God, you got to hear Brent Midland. How lucky you were." And you realize that, you know, look, it's just as a matter of when you're born and when it falls for you and who you get to see, you know. But Miles Davis and the Dead would have been great.
And back to Frank Zappa for a second. We did listen to a lot of back in the 70s. Mm-hmm. And for our listeners who maybe want to get pointed in the right direction to check out Frank Zappa. Some of the songs I remember from the 70s were Pajama People. Remember that song?
Sure.
And then Going to Montana, I'm going to be a dental floss cowboy.
Yes, yes, yes. Well, that was the thing about Zappa, was that, you know, his lyrics were irreverent. Oftentimes he was poking fun at, you know, groups of people. He did a teenage Jewish princess song, as I recall, that got a lot of airplay for a while. And, but he did it in such a way that there was never a terrible backlash, although a lot of people, not a lot of people, but some people may be too young to remember his very famous showdowns with Tipper Gore, when Al Gore was the vice president and Tipper, his wife, was part of a commission to make musicians put warning labels on their records for sexually explicit lyrics. And Zappa really took off after her. He was a true free speech kind of guy. Say what you want to say, and if you don't like it, don't listen. And those were, you know, looking back on that now and thinking about it, that was really hysterical that, you know, Frank Zappa waded his way into public politics and, you know, started taking shots at somebody like Tipper Gore. That was really funny.
Yes, I believe the name of the song that he produced with his daughter when she was a teenager, was it Valley Girls?
Yes, correct. Right. There was a Valley Girls song, too, where they all did the Valley speak. And, you know, all of a sudden, you know, kids all around the country, because they got onto FM radio, were all doing that whole Valley. Hey, let's go to the mall. I can't even do it. But sure, that was very funny, too. And you know, and some of his lyrics got a little sexually suggestive in a way that probably would never find any playtime on public radio. But at the same time, where, you know, he could get away with it, though, Jim, I say, because he was probably, you know, one of the top five, maybe even, you know, top 10 for sure, maybe top five guitarists who ever played. I mean, he was musically exceptionally, exceptionally trained and talented, you know, kind of like in the Phil Lesh mode of somebody who's not just a rock guitarist, but, you know, can write symphony orchestra presentations.
Yes. Well, we're coming to the end of our time slot. And
we are.
I would encourage all our listeners to ask your friends to listen to our podcast, The Deadhead Cannabis Show. Every episode we've ever recorded is on my company's website, the Bridge West CPA firm website. You can listen to it or other locations that, Larry, you might have some that you can plug.
Yeah, sure. The Hoban website is always a great place to find the show. And I know that we have a new app. But since I'm very technically challenged when it comes to apps, I would just tell people to go to our website, and hopefully Dan will have something there that explains about the apps. But it is kind of cool that we're, you know, from my perspective at least, that we're big time, baby, when we have an app. I love that. Before we go today, Jim, I just have to do a very, very quick shout out to a Hoban colleague of mine, Garrett Graff. Garrett is the managing partner at the Hoban Law Firm and probably one of the top hemp attorneys in the entire country, cannabis all around, but has really, really made a name for himself in hemp. And I'm giving him a shout out because either just yesterday or this morning, he and his wife just had their second baby, a little boy named Dylan Graff. So Garrett, congratulations. I'm sorry, I don't remember your daughter's name, but now she has a younger brother, Dylan, and hopefully you guys will be up to the task of man-to-man defense there with the kids. So having said that, Jim, why don't you take us home?
Very good. Over and out from sunny and warm and green Massachusetts, and over and out from Jim Marty here.
Bye, Jim. Have safe travels out there. We'll look forward to talking to you next week. This is Larry Mishkin signing out from Chicago. Have a good week, everyone, and stay safe.